Law and Grace, Chapter 13, Part A, Christ, the End of the Law. The Law Fulfilled and Superseded. The Pattern in the Mount. At the heart of the camp stood the sanctuary. Its position was proof of its importance. It was there that the cloud hovered above the tabernacle, bespeaking God's presence in the midst of his people. There that sacrifice had to be presented and atonement made. There alone that the priesthood could perform its indispensable mediatorial work. Was in fact the very pivot of the nation's life, being central not only to the camp, but also to the law at large. All this was by decree of God. Let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them, had been his simple edict. It was Israel's duty and privilege to put it into execution. So to them exclusively was left the task of building it. Not so, however, the responsibility of settling its design. God reserved for himself sole right to decide what that should be. To the edict itself he attached a stringent qualification. According to all that I show thee, after the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of the instruments thereof, even so shall he make it. In making the stipulation, God clearly intimated that he could accept the worship of Israel only on terms determined by himself. But he did more besides. He revealed that these terms would on this occasion be communicated to Moses in a peculiar way. Everything from the greatest detail, the tabernacle, down to the smallest, the instruments thereof, had to be the replica of a heavenly original. Thou shalt rear up the tabernacle according to the fashion thereof, which was showed thee in the mount, were God's instructions to Moses. That is, God did more than inform him verbally how to build it. He also showed him visibly what he wanted done by confronting him with a prototype of his own, which it was Moses' duty to have reproduced with scrupulous exactitude. This meant that what the people saw take shape slowly before them and eventually reared up in their midst was in fact nothing more than a representation of something else, a mere copy only. Not what they themselves had built, but the pattern shown to Moses in the mount, that, and that alone, was the true, the real tabernacle. Yet that pattern in its turn bore witness to another, to a moral and spiritual house of God, of which the completed sanctuary, its ritual, its ministry, its sacrifices, its furnishings, and everything else included, was but an allegorical anticipation. In this, the sanctuary was of a piece with the law as a whole, for its intrinsic limitations were also those of the entire system of which it formed the centerpiece. In all its departments, in fact, the law confessed itself in this way to be lacking in finality, to be the type only, not the substance. The priesthood, for example, spoke of direct access to God, yet in so doing it admitted its inability to effect such access for those who sought it. Other sacrifices likewise witnessed in chorus to the need for one perfect, all-availing offering which would make an utter end of sin. Yet in the process they acknowledged themselves to be powerless to bring what was desirable to pass. The land again loomed before the wilderness wanderers as the final goal of all their wanderings. Yet upon their entry into it, they found it to be but the foretaste of an eternal inheritance still to come, and themselves to be still only strangers and sojourners there with God. All holy days and festivals also spoke eloquently of an eternal Sabbath and redemptive rest, but all alike, failing to usher it in, confessed themselves to be only adumbrations of it, and no more. And thus the law quickened men's hopes, only to leave them frustrated and unsatisfied. It took men as far as the veil, as it were, but not into the perfection and eternity symbolized beyond. Yet the law, nevertheless, still sustained men's hopes, even in the very process of disappointing them. What it confessed itself unable to do of its own, it thereby left for something else to accomplish in its place. Through sheer force of repetition, it persuaded men to believe that all that it foreshadowed would one day assuredly come to fulfillment. It intimated that it lacked finality, not because finality was unattainable, but because it was to be attained through something other than the law itself. What it left men to infer for themselves, of course, was that when that something had at last come, the law's own usefulness would have ceased, and it would have become as unnecessary as the scaffolding of a building which had reached completion, and would in the same way need to be dispensed with. For all with eyes to perceive, the law clearly testified that whatever eventually fulfilled it would also inevitably supersede it. It is an axiom in all things that when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. To this the law was no exception, predicting that the ideal would one day certainly be realized. It simultaneously predicted its own abrogation and eclipse. When the reality came eventually into view, inevitably the copy would have to be discarded. Christ above the law. For the law, with its symbolical idiom and allegorical designs, every leper and everyone that hath an issue and whosoever is defiled by the dead was a signal type of sin and its effects. When therefore the law excluded them from the camp and denied them access to the sanctuary, it did so with a distinct didactic purpose, that of teaching its fundamental lesson that sin cuts men off from God. But having banished them from the camp, there it left them to their unhappy plight. So long as they remained defiled, there was no question of their returning to it. Now, on rare occasions, lepers and those with issues recovered normal health. When this occurred, the law could, of course, with perfect consistency, readmit them to the camp. And this it did, as we have seen. Yet, until this recovery occurred, it did nothing whatever to help them recover bodily soundness. Having banned them, It ceased, as it were, to be interested in them in any active way. In the case of those defiled by the dead, however, common sense demanded some action on the part of the law, yet the action which it took to deal with this special case did not in fact alter the general principle. During their 7 days' uncleanness, those defiled by the dead were ritually dead. That is, they symbolized the dead. And like lepers and those with issues, the law held them at a distance, yet did nothing to succor them. It was compelled, however, to make allowance for the fact that they were all still living people, and that it could not sustain the illusion that they were dead indefinitely at their expense. It was here that the ritual of the red heifer so wonderfully came to the rescue. It first of all enabled these technically dead people to come alive again and make a new beginning as normal living people on the eighth day after they had contracted defilement. Then it did this in such a way as to make it clear that it was not the law itself which restored these dead to life. It thus served to maintain the principle that the law could not take an active interest, either in lepers, those with issues, or the dead, so long as those in any of these three categories still remained in their wretched state. Having excluded them from the camp, the law had no further use for them. It was thus perfectly consistent, even in the anomalous case of those defiled by the dead. In all three cases, it confessed that it killed, but could not make alive. That it specialized in denouncing sin, but could do absolutely nothing to remove it. Now, how strikingly different in the light of this is the treatment which those in all three of these classes received from Jesus. The law chased them away and they fled before it. But in contrast, they sought the presence of Jesus of their own accord. The law did nothing for them because it could do nothing. Jesus, on the other hand, took pity on them and delivered them from their plight. Descending from the mount, he was confronted by a leper. The law ordered the latter to shun the company of his fellows like an outlaw. But instead of crying, as the law commanded, "Unclean, unclean," espying Jesus, the man came and worshipped him, saying, "Lord, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean." The drama of the situation was tremendous. The law declared the man unclean, but he was convinced that Jesus could make him clean. It was not the power of Jesus which the man doubted, but only his willingness. Hence the pathetic plea, "Lord, if thou wilt." There came the gracious answer which he longed for. Jesus put forth his hand and touched him, saying, "I will, be thou clean." The Lord's fiat took instant effect. Immediately we read, his leprosy was cleansed. It was cleansed, we note, by the touch of Jesus. That fact is remarkable. We know from the next miracle, the healing of the centurion's servant, that Jesus did not actually need to touch any diseased person in order to heal him, yet he deliberately touched the leper. That is, according to the law, he deliberately came into contact with sin as embodied in the man and as symbolized in his disease. Yet, with what effect? The man's disease and so his power to communicate uncleanness ceased upon an instant. A fact more staggering still if we visualize Jesus touching not only the man as such, but his leprous sores in particular. The miracle accomplished, the leper could proceed forthwith to present himself to the priest as a cleansed man, as the law prescribed. In view of what happened, therefore, it would clearly be incongruous and grotesque to think of Jesus as contracting defilement by such contact. And precisely the same situation arose over the case of the woman which was diseased with an issue of blood 12 years. She came behind him and touched the hem of his garment. Now the law decreed expressly, whomsoever he that hath the issue toucheth, without having rinsed his hands in water, he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water, and he be unclean until the even. This would hold good automatically for any woman also who had an issue, for with her too the rule was, whosoever toucheth her shall be unclean until the even. There is no mention in any of the three records of the incident that the woman washed her hands. And the reason is obvious. She felt no compulsion to do so because she had no fear of communicating uncleanness to Jesus. All she was concerned to do was to touch him, however slightly. She had no doubt of the outcome, for she said within herself, "If I may but touch his garment, I shall be whole." She was not mistaken. Once again, the effect of the touch of Jesus made the idea of his contracting uncleanness seem too fantastic for words. Straightway, the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of that plague. Virtue in Jesus put an immediate end to defilement in her. It was defilement which recoiled before him, not he who recoiled before defilement, as embodied in the woman. This was clearly a case for which the law did not cater. Its prescription of uncleanness was simply in a applicable to such a man as this. The healing of Jairus' daughter threw that momentous fact into even greater relief. The maid lay dead. Therefore, all that came into the house had, according to the law, to be unclean 7 days. Notwithstanding, Jesus entered. He did even more. He came into actual contact with the corpse. Yet, with what an amazing result, he took her by the hand and the maid arose. Once again, it was not the healer, but the victim who was affected by the touch. And once again, it was one whom the law was powerless to succor, for whom this was done. Once again, therefore, the contraction by him of uncleanness was palpably out of the question. The law simply ceased to operate in circumstances like these. Marvellousness of these healings was merely indicative of the marvellousness of the man who performed them. Faced with such unique power, the law broke down, yet more in appearance than in fact. It actually, in this matter, fulfilled itself despite itself. It forbade contact with lepers, those with issues, and those defiled by the dead for a specific purpose, to teach allegorically that those within the camp, as distinct from those without, were sinless. Ritually, those without were sin incarnate. So contact with them became in the allegory a contact with and participation in sin. But paradoxically, Through contact with Jesus, such people cease immediately to be sin incarnate, according to the allegorical requirements of the law. They in fact became, ritually, sinless. And through mere contact with him, what therefore could he be but sinless himself? That was precisely what Jesus claimed to be. His enemies taunted him, "This fellow doth not cast out devils, but by Beelzebub, the prince of devils." And to this slander the Lord gave a devastating answer. "How can one enter into a strong man's house and spoil his goods, except he first bind the strong man, and then he will spoil his house?" Sick folk, as his enemies well knew, because the law had taught them so, were in Satan's house and held prisoner by him there. There was therefore one way only to release them, to bind the binder first. Jesus had, as they could not deny, stolen Satan's prisoners from him. And from that he argued that he had previously rendered sin impotent. This he could only have claimed, of course, had he been sinless. And this, in actual fact, he was. So it was for that reason that observance of the prescribed cleansing ritual would have been incongruous in him, for cleansing bespoke defilement, and defilement bespoke sin. But in him there was no sin, as his cures proved. There was therefore no room or reason for ritual cleansing either, as was sometimes required by the law. And thus the law fulfilled itself despite itself, for he met to the full its ritual demands for holiness, but on that same account stood exempt from its ritual demands for cleansing, because of the confession of sin which these implied. His acts of physical healing were in fact tokens of his moral and spiritual power. They brought upon men the obligation to recognize that God was working through him. As the plagues had forced the magicians of Egypt to admit that God was working through Moses. Balked by their failure to counterfeit the plague of lice, the magicians had said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." Jesus in turn said, "If I with the finger of God cast out devils, no doubt the kingdom of God is come upon you." "The kingdom of God is come," said Jesus with urgent emphasis. The claim was terrific, because he had come, the kingdom had come. There was no mistaking his claim. It was a claim to be the embodiment of all that the kingdom signified, the eruption of the divine into human life, the revealing to mortal gaze of the moral counterpart of the pattern shown to Moses in the Mount, the reality of which the law was but a shadow. And in keeping with that fact, he offered rest to men. "Come unto me, all ye that labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." He had given it in one form to the leper, to the woman, and to the deceased maiden. But that had merely established his authority to offer it to all in a more real form still, in the form of rest, not only from the effects of sin, but also from sin itself, and so from all the bondage which went with it. The law merely shackled sin upon men like some crushing weight. Take my yoke upon you, said he, in pointed contrast, and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. In the same way as Israel had exchanged servitude to Pharaoh in favor of servitude to God, so he invited the people to exchange the law's yoke for his, and to find spiritual solace and freedom by so doing. The law condemned men for their sins. Christ offered them instead the forgiveness of these sins. Each cure was in fact but an example of such forgiveness in symbolic form, precisely because each disease he cured was ultimately attributable to sin. The cure was in each case but the outward proof of his right to offer men the true rest, to wit, release from sin's grip upon them. And this he demonstrated most conspicuously in his healing of the palsied man. The man's paralysis was but the badge of sin's hold upon him. And so to heal him, Jesus stated simply, Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven thee. The onlookers were scandalized, but needlessly so, as Jesus proceeded to prove by submitting his claims to a practical test. Any fraud could claim to have effected a change in a man when no visible change in that man was necessitated by the claim. The forgiveness of sins was such a case. On the other hand, only a genuine man would deliberately stake his authority upon his ability to vindicate that claim by visible results. And they knew that. So Jesus acted on it. Wherefore think ye evil in your hearts, for whether is easier to say, thy sins be forgiven thee, or to say, arise and walk? But that ye may know that the Son of Man hath power on earth to forgive sins, then saith he to the sick of the palsy, arise, take up thy bed, and go unto thine house. You can imagine with what bated breath the onlookers waited to see what would happen. Some of them, consumed with hatred, hoping that Jesus had committed a fatal error and would expose himself to be the impostor which they took him to be. But lo, the paralytic arose and departed to his house, carrying with him the bed which previously had carried him. And when the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God, which had given such power unto men. And small wonder. If the power was unique, so was the man who received it, as the transfiguration signally proved. With Jesus upon the Holy Mount appeared Moses, the representative of the law, and Elijah, the representative of the prophets. They also appeared in glory before the wondering gaze of the disciples, and spake of his decease, that is, Exodus, which he should accomplish at Jerusalem. The two Old Testament worthies were moving away from Jesus when Peter, in mistaken zeal, suggested that a tabernacle should be built for each of them. In doing this, he ranked all three, Moses, Elijah, and Jesus, as equals. And while he thus spoke, there came a cloud and overshadowed them. And they feared as they entered into the cloud. And there came a voice out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son. Hear him." The divine pronouncement was rich in Old Testament allusion, especially in Matthew's longer form. "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." One prophet had spoken of a son who would be heir of the world, another of a servant in whom God's soul would be delighted, and before them, Moses had spoken of a prophet whose words would be God's words, words which men would perforce have to heed. The son, the servant, and the prophet, said the voice in effect, are one and the same individual. And he is Jesus. The departure of Moses and Elijah after giving testimony to his impending death was therefore most significant. It meant not only that the testimony of both law and prophets culminated and fulfilled itself in Jesus, but also that having done so, it had thereby been superseded by his own. When the voice was passed, Jesus was found alone. Moses had gone. Elijah had gone. But Jesus remained alone. He, coming after them, had eclipsed them, being greater than both. That was the obvious moral. And that was why Peter's suggestion had been so utterly inappropriate. He had indeed made it, not knowing what he said. To his superiority, Jesus made repeated and uncompromising claim, never more expressively than when he overrode the law. He did this when he healed the cripple at the pool of Bethesda. He healed the man with the simple words, "Rise, take up thy bed and walk." The man did as he was bidden, and like the palsied man, bore off his bed, the badge of his impotence, like some trophy of victory. The Jews were scandalized. This was the Sabbath day, and Jesus had ordered the man to carry his bed. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus. They did this blindly, for what they failed to see were the implications of the miracle. The man's ability to carry his bed after 38 years of helplessness should have been positive proof to them of the authority of Jesus to bid him carry it. By way of answer, Jesus merely pointed out that the Sabbath, precisely because it testified so emphatically of rest and made the observance of it so stringent a matter, was evidence that God himself was ceaselessly active on man's behalf. It signified that while man reposed, God toiled to restore that first creative rest which human sin had so tragically disturbed, so that men might enjoy rest not only one day in seven, but also throughout eternity. My Father worketh hitherto. That sufficed for him. Better justification than that, there could not be for him to do the same work. Nay, his activity having the same object as God's, the granting of release to those in sin's bondage, the translation of the symbolism of the Sabbath into fact, No day could actually be more appropriate for it than the Sabbath itself. What was right for God must also be right for him. So having said, "My Father worketh hitherto," he added significantly, "and I work." His enemies were quick to perceive the far-reaching implications of his words. His adding to his breach, as they thought, of the Sabbath, the claim to have God as his Father, stirred up their bitterest hatred. But Jesus was unmoved, calmly repeated that he was simply modelling himself upon his Father. "Verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he seeth the Father do, for what things soever he doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise. For the Father loveth the Son, and showeth him all things that himself doeth." His was no hireling observance of the law, no offering in a spirit of commercialism of work to God for his approval, but rather the imitation of God as a son. He was instructed by God as to what was right and moved by God to do it. It had been revealed to him for what the Sabbath stood. Therefore, he sought instinctively to express its meaning in concrete terms, and in fact did so both in his own sinlessness and also in his deliverance of those, such as the cripple at the pool, who were in bondage to sin. It was thus no anomaly for him to do God's saving work upon the Sabbath, but rather something sublimely fitting, as right and proper as their own circumcision of a man upon the eighth day, when even that eighth day was a Sabbath. In his life of sinlessness, of always doing God's will, he had fully realized the meaning of the Sabbath. Its technicalities had therefore no jurisdiction over him, any more than upon occasions they had over other ministers of God. "Have ye not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless?" The temple, that is, and its requirements, were of greater authority than the Sabbath law, it being the abode of him who gave that law to Israel. Of how much greater authority, therefore, was he himself, who was in reality what the temple was, in symbol only. "But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple." If only they had grasped what his coming signified, they would have never have taken the attitude towards him which they did. "If ye had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, ye would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day." Lord, we note, not servant. That is, one above the law, not slavishly subject to it. And this he proceeded forthwith to demonstrate by healing the man with a withered hand in the synagogue nearby. Once more it was the Sabbath, therefore once more it was fitting that he, as the embodiment of all that the Sabbath connoted, should give a man rest from sin upon that very day, and in token of that very fact. That is, what seemed in him a breach of the law was really nothing but its complete fulfillment, the bringing to reality of all that it foreshadowed, not only in the Sabbath, but also in everything else pertaining to it.